Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Finance Diaries podcast. My name is Stephanie, and I'm here to teach you everything there is to know about personal finances. Whether it's the stuff that you didn't learn in school, that your friends and family don't really tend to talk about, and that quite frankly we could say is treated like it's a secret diary even. I'm here to unlock and open up that secret diary for you, and that is why I welcome you to another episode of the Finance Diaries podcast. Again, this is on my YouTube channel, and this is also everywhere that you can stream podcasts. This is a new thing I'm trying out. Let's see how well it ends up working. Stay tuned for the updates. I want to talk to you today about some investing and finance and money tips that I've heard and what exactly I think about them. Because I'm always reading articles and I don't fully agree with what's on there. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to be good with money. I always say this, but personal finances are personal. There are some things that are kind of like ground rules for everyone. Like obviously like don't spend all your money or you won't have any. But then there are things that are more personal. Well, what did you spend the money on? Because maybe you were spending it on buying asset producing assets. Well, in that case, then obviously it's a little bit different than if you were spending your money on like outfits to go to the club and bottles in the club and stuff like that. Anyways, I want to talk to you about a couple of them. One of them that I was reading yesterday is one that I hadn't heard before, but I really have been thinking about it since I read this article. I can't even remember what I was reading, but one of the pieces of advice was to stop spending time worrying about the $30 questions when you should be thinking about the $30,000 questions. And I kind of researched that more and I looked into what exactly that was talking about because it really piqued my interest. What does that mean? And what they were saying was kind of the age-old debate in finances is, are those like $30 that you're spending a day on like coffee and lunch, is that really going to make the difference between you being financially successful and you not being financially successful? And the answer to this in this regard was that no, that you should be spending a lot more time focusing on the bigger things, like a down payment on an income property or a down payment on a house or like the $30,000 questions plus, obviously. So if you're buying a house, where can you get the best interest rate from? Where can you put your money that it's the most like producing more money for you, like which stock or which index fund or which kind of investment should you stay away from? And I think that I don't fully agree with that one. After looking at it, yes, of course, those are very important. And I do agree that a lot of people don't really shop for mortgage rates. They don't really understand what is going on when they sign for a house. And that is fully understandable because who taught us anything about that? Maybe just a little side tangent here, but I remember during COVID, it was determined in Canada. So in Canada, we have a lot of different interest rates that you can have. If you're from the US or another country, maybe this sounds completely crazy to you, but in Canada, we don't have interest rates fixed for the entire length of your mortgage. So in the US, you'd sign a 30-year mortgage and your 30-year mortgage is going to have the same interest rate for the full 30 years. So your amortization in that case is 30 years, but the term is also 30 years. So the term of your rate. In Canada, generally, we don't really do 30-year mortgages unless you put down more than 20%. Typically, the mortgage is 25 years, and generally, the fixed term is 5 years. That's what people tend to go for. I think that it's maybe more promoted by like the mortgage brokers and lenders. I'm not really quite sure why. I should find out about that. But that's like the typical mortgage that you would have here. So after 5 years is up, when your term is done, that means that you have to go back to either the same lender or different lenders and figure out what exactly the market rate is at now and then pay whatever that is. A lot of people don't shop around for different mortgage rates. They might go to their bank where they do their banking and just say, hey, I want a mortgage and go that way. But that like 0.1 or 0.2 or even like an entire percentage could make a really, really big difference if you're going to a lender maybe doing some sort of promotion or something like that and changing that rate. So let's say you get this typical 5-year term, you get the lowest rate possible and you're happy. Then 5 years comes up and you look around and you get the best rate again. So there you go. You're looking at the $30,000 question. Where can I get the best rate from? What happened over the last 2 years with COVID is that a lot of lenders were, I can't really speak to why they were doing this. Maybe because the more often you renegotiate, the more often they make a commission. Or maybe they were really just trying to get it to go through so that they could make the commission in the first place. But what was happening was that a lot of lenders were kind of making people go towards variable rates. That was the typical rate that they would give people. Now, in general, with fixed terms means that you're for that entire 5 years, the 5-year fixed, or if you choose 10-year fixed, or 3-year fixed, or 2-year fixed, you're going to pay the same interest rate throughout that entire period. So every month or every week or however often you choose to do your payments, that's going to be like, that's always what you're paying. But with a variable rate, you're variable with the market. So if the market rate, so like, for example, how Bank of Canada just announced another rate hike and might, well, this is a bit later. You're going to hear this later than I recorded it. But whenever there's a rate hike, that means that there's usually interest rates are going to go up. So that means that your variable rate's going to go up. If it goes down, it goes down. And what they were doing was that they were pushing people towards these variable rates so that they could qualify for mortgages. They were saying, okay, this is the rate. And people didn't really ask many questions because not everyone understands mortgages, which is very fair. And this ties into just asking as many questions as you can whenever you're dealing with financial matters. And what started happening was that as rates started going up and up and up and up, people were starting to struggle with their payments because their payments were going higher. Or even worse, if you had a fixed payment, variable rate, so I know that sounds confusing. Basically, that means you're using a variable interest rate, but every month you're paying the same amount. So let's say you're paying $2,000 a month. Well, what started happening was that at one point you hit something called your trigger rate. Your trigger rate means that all $2,000 you're paying is only going towards interest. There's not even $1 going towards the principal amount that you borrowed. Like if you borrowed $200,000 for a house, you're not even touching that anymore. And so banks were saying, okay, you have a couple options. You can give us a lump sum and we can kind of rework from there. We can re-amortize your entire mortgage, or you can go on to a fixed rate, but that it's going to be a lot higher. And that's where people are still hitting them now, and people are struggling with their housing payments. Now, before you assume that that means that the housing market is gonna collapse, that's not really accurate because houses and housing tends to be the last thing that people let go of. They will stop eating out, drinking alcohol, shopping, doing all that stuff before they contemplate selling their house because usually people think that they can ride it out. So don't cross your fingers on that. I know I went off on a bit of a tangent here, but rates are really important. And that's what I'm trying to say, is that it is really important to understand what we're signing. And if you don't understand rates and you don't feel like you're getting the adequate amount of answers from your lender, it's a really good idea to speak to someone that you know and trust that can help you out with this, because a house is a huge purchase. And when we don't worry too much about the rates and we don't worry too much about what we're paying, well, then that's the $30,000 question that we're kind of just giving up. I think that it's a really good idea to do this and to look around and to find out as many things as you can. Like, did you know that in Canada, if you choose to pay your mortgage on a weekly basis, if you're on a fixed rate, well, you can actually squeeze in some extra payments going towards your capital each year. So you're actually paying the same amount that you would be paying if you were paying on a monthly basis, but you're getting a little bit more to chip off at your house. On top of that, you don't actually have to only pay what your mortgage is. If you decide, so for example, one of my homes, I decided to make an extra $133 payment per month. So that amount, that extra that I'm paying, it adds 15% to my original payment. That 15% added on is going to straight to the amount that I originally borrowed. So not $1 of that is going to be interest. That actually means that amortized over the 30-year length of my mortgage, I know this might sound confusing, but it cuts off 7.5 years by paying $133 more a month. And so many people don't know that, which I mean is fair, because how would you know that? Like, friends don't just get together and start talking mortgages usually. But that is something you should definitely do. Maybe now you've learned that on this podcast and you can go and talk to your friends about it. So those $30,000 questions are really important, but I think in order to even be considering the $30,000 questions, the $30 questions are really important too. Because if you have this habit that you're always spending that like $30, $50 every day, I think that it prevents you from even getting to the possibility of making those $30,000 purchases. So that's where I kind of disagree with that statement. I do understand that those questions are really important. If ever you look at, I know I'm talking a lot about mortgages, but it's really relevant right now. But if you look at a mortgage calculator and you look what even just a couple points of a percentage, like 0.2 or 0.3 over your entire mortgage, it does make a difference. So that was that one. I think that that kind of ties into the whole coffee and like avocado toast and stuff like that, of people always arguing if that actually makes a difference in your finances. And that's why I want to tie into the next point, is watching your spending. This is one that I think is really important, because this ties back into lifestyle creep. And lifestyle creep, it sucks to talk about, because we often realize that we have been doing it when we think about what it is. So lifestyle creep is essentially, as you might move up in your company, or you might make more in your business, or whatever it is that you're getting more money, that your lifestyle starts to like increase in, like, increases your spending increases in increments as well. So let's say you get a promotion and then you're like, okay, well, I can get a nicer apartment now. And then you get another promotion. You're like, well, I should get a nicer car now too. And then as you're doing this, you're maybe going out more, you're going out for drinks more, you're going to nicer restaurants. And then as you're doing this, at one point you realize that, hey, my spending habits are really different than they were 2 years ago. And I can't even consider, I don't know, going into my dream job industry and taking a pay cut because I won't be able to afford it. So lifestyle creep really sucks. And I think that the avocado toast and the coffee and all that stuff, I always like to think of it in this way. College Stephanie like didn't really have two pennies to scrub together. I think that was when I was working in a movie theater then. And I really just didn't make very good money. I had no interest in working at clubs. Like, I just I liked to be in bed. It was too loud and I just had no interest. I knew you could make really good money and I just didn't want to. But anyways, I worked at a movie theater, and I want to think that I was really good with money then. If Stephanie from then wouldn't have spent money on it, then I probably shouldn't spend money on it now. And that's how I like to think about things. Maybe you don't need to be that dramatic, but I also have really ambitious financial goals. So I think that that's part of why I'm always thinking about things that way. I think that those little purchases do add up, and those habits really do add up. And I want to make sure that I'm always in control of my spending. I spoke last week about spending and like why exactly we do it and the psychology behind it. And I think that it's really important that we always know why we're spending money on something, and we're not just doing it because we're used to it or because our friend is doing it and stuff like that. So the avocado toast and the coffee, I do think it makes a difference if you look at the bigger picture. Not having like an occasional latte or something like that, that is obviously completely fine. I don't disagree with that kind of spending at all. So then, maybe another kind of financial point that I think of is, I don't know if this is really like, it's not a blanket statement for everyone, but I think that having roommate agreements, cohabitation agreements, prenups, all those contracts, they might seem like they're overboard, but I really do think that they protect people financially. My ideology behind it is that, like, best case scenario, you never need to use it. It's just a document that you sign that exists somewhere. But if you really did end up in the worst case scenario and you did need to use it, how upset would you be that you didn't have it? And obviously, like, no one packs an umbrella on a sunny day, but like, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't own one. Does that make sense? I think that that's like somewhere that people can get like in really awful situations, especially if the spending was disproportionate. For example, like, I'm a huge investor, and if I like was moving in with whoever, I'd want to make sure that I'm protected and maybe they're not in a great financial situation. And I just want to prevent those kinds of things from happening. I also don't know how my situation would turn around. You never know if you're going to, like, maybe you're like, I don't have two pennies to scrub together. I don't need like any of these things. But then maybe like you have a great aunt Matilda who passes away and leaves you an inheritance. And then all of a sudden you're like, okay, wait, wait. And you actually can sign, if you are married and you never signed one, you can sign a post-nuptial agreement. Those exist as well. I think that agreements are just like the absolute best thing to have. And I know there's a lot of arguments out there about like trust and like loving each other and all this stuff. And agreed, you can absolutely love each other. I think if you really loved each other, you would sign an agreement like that because you'd want this person to be as protected as possible if ever anything happened. So I think it's the opposite of what some people are saying. So I think that that is something that's really important to do. I know that this one's maybe a bit touchy, but I think that there are a lot of comments often in my Instagram DMs of people saying that there are issues with how I present information because not everyone has the same lifestyle as me. Like some people have kids and some people are supporting parents and some people are doing this, that, and the other. And I think that that's one of the things that I really think about is that, am I feeling like I'm in a financial position that I would want to have children? And I know that that is something that like everyone needs to consider on a different basis. And obviously accidents happen, surprises happen. You might like go in whichever direction, you might end up like with a family member's child or like so many different situations happen. But I want to put myself in the best financial position I can before it comes time to having a family. So if you already have a family, which often this happens, is someone will have a family and realize that their finances are not in the best situation and then come to me asking like what exactly they can do. So one of the first things that I think is really important to have for your children, and even if you don't know anything about finances, I think is really important, is to have some sort of children's like savings account. And I know that these are different depending on which country. In Canada, we have something called an RESP, so a Registered Education Savings Plan. And it's silly that they call it a savings plan. It's really an investing account. It's like a TFSA or an RSP. And in the US, I think that there's something as well. I can't remember what it's called, but usually around the world, there are these different kinds of accounts that you can have and start putting a little bit of money away as you go. And because of the fact that you start contributing, you can literally do this from the day they're born. You can contribute very small amounts that can add up over time. And these are the kinds of accounts that you can have managed. And that means that you don't actually have to make any of the financial decisions. So if you have kids and, or you're thinking about having kids and you're maybe like not fully sure about like how to manage their future and their education and all these different things, it's really important to do something like that to help them in the future so that if they do decide that they want to pursue secondary, post-secondary education or even just education in general or anything that they want to do, that you have some sort of investment for them. I've seen some crazy things with that. Like I've seen people that take it way past just an education account. I've seen a YouTuber, I can't remember who it was, I'm sorry. If you know who it is, you can let me know in the comments, that had bought really like decrepit properties, a couple townhouses, and I think there were three or four of them. And this person had fixed them up like on their own, so not a ton of money, but like still a lot of money because it's four townhouses. And fix them up, and each child was given like this home, and they all had to, as they grew up, learn how to like go and manage the rent payments, like helping schedule maintenance. Like, I mean, obviously not when they're like two, but just understanding finances and how they go along. And all that money that they were making was going into their investing account, which was going to be for like their school. And this home was essentially one day going to be theirs, and they would be able to manage it however they wanted. Like if they wanted to move in, if they wanted to keep collecting rent, if they wanted to move in with roommates. And I thought that was such an interesting way of teaching kids about money. I know it's obviously extreme, especially if you're struggling and you have kids, you're not going to go out and buy them a house the day that they're born, but just kind of different ideas that you can have with kids. I didn't have an allowance growing up, and so this again ties with kids, and I don't really think that an allowance is a good financial principle at all. Like, I disagree entirely with it. I think that allowances, it's just like you're learning to get handouts, which obviously we don't get in society. I think, if anything, I had a friend growing up who had a chore list, and he didn't have to do all of them, and I remember some of them were extreme, but whatever he chose to do, he'd get remunerated for. So he'd get an allowance for whatever it is that he did do, and it depended on which tasks he got done. Like, some of it was like dusting, cleaning, but then it would be like taking everything out of the fridge, washing it, reorganizing it, but then it went down to like crazy tasks like something about the oil tank, like maintaining the oil tank, which is a bit much, but like anywhere that his parents saved money, they were like, we'll offer it to you. And then on top of that, this kid was taxed, which was like, okay, maybe you hate that idea, but I think it's great. Taxed to learn that money, like, you don't just get everything that's written out on your salary or chore list, that you have to give some of it back. Maybe like a bit extreme, but I love that example, like helping learn that it's not just like you're not just given money at random. So I love those different principles. I think they're great to start your kids off on the right financial journey, even if you don't know that much about finances yourself. So sorry, I did go off on a bit of a tangent there about about decisions to have kids, but these are things that you can do if you are already in that situation and you want to help them learn about money, but you're not too sure on how to educate them yourselves. So I don't know, I'm trying to think of some other tips that I might have heard. I think that there was one of them about keeping your expenses low that talked about roommates and staying at home as long as possible. And this was one that I read about the other day. There was an article in Insider, and it was about a guy who paid off his house in 7.5 years. He paid off his, like, I think it was a $400,000 townhouse. And all the comments were like, oh, I bet mom and dad like gave him an inheritance and all this stuff. And it's actually not. So what he did was, originally after school, he did like I did, and he stayed living at home. He explained to his parents that if he lived at home for these 2 years, he'd be able to save like X amount of his salary for a down payment, and then would be able to like own a house rather than waste his money on rent. So his parents like were like, okay, we'll let you do that. And he ends up saving up. He gets this townhouse. He spends way more than he wanted to spend because house prices had just shot up. This was in the early 2000s. And his mom said, well, why don't you get roommates and you can pay it off faster? And he was, I think, 24 at the time or something like that. And in his head, it was just like, well, I don't really want roommates if I'm buying a house. But he put that aside and he got roommates. I think he got 3 roommates. And for 7.5 years, till he was like 32, he had roommates. And he just really wanted a paid off house. And in it, he recognizes that paying off your house isn't necessarily the best financial decision, because interest rates can be so low on mortgages that like you can invest it and blah, blah, blah. But in his mind, he decided personal finances are personal and I want to pay off my house as soon as possible so that it's just not something I need to worry about. And he kept these roommates. And I know that like there's so many things about like staying living at home and having roommates that like, I don't know why it's attributed to being embarrassing. I think it's not. He said he struggled because he was an introvert and having so many people around like gave him a struggle, but he also paid off his house in 7.5 years. Like, he would just make all these extra payments. So like, who was laughing at the end? And then he also said it ended up helping his career because he felt comfortable making career moves that he wouldn't have felt comfortable making if he was worrying about a mortgage payment every month. And his wife was able to take care of her disabled sister and be a stay-at-home mom and like run a side business. So anyways, it ended up being great. And all because he had roommates, he lived at home a little bit longer than is socially acceptable. And he paid off his mortgage, which isn't something that people usually want to do in the world of finances. But he actually did measure it compared to the performance he would have had in the S&P 500. And it was like 0.1% difference that he would have made. So he was really happy with his decision in the end. I think that that kind of sums up, like, before I go on a tangent, of a lot of things about finances. I don't think finances are like black and white. And I don't think that everything that you hear, you should just take it and apply it to your life. I always say on here that like these things are just my opinion and what I think about it. And I think that the most important thing that we can do is like get the conversation flowing about finances. Feel comfortable talking about mortgage rates, feel comfortable talking about how you're planning for like your kids' future, how you're planning to like wait to start a family, or that you want to start a family ASAP and you can like catch up later on your career. Whatever it is that you want to do, finances are entirely personal. And I think that you need to take this information, like give yourself a moment to think about it like I did, spend this day thinking about it, and then apply whatever it is that you think is relevant or not relevant to your life. It's important to be critical thinkers, and you can't just read everything or hear things on TikTok and just go invest in it. I think that a lot of people can find out that they'll get burned really fast doing that. So make sure that you analyze everything, that you find out all of the information before you decide to make a decision. Thanks so much, guys. Can't wait to hear what you have to say about my new YouTube platform. Take care and have a great day.